Water.
Privatization.
Electricity.
Privatization.
Healthcare.
Privatization.
Education.
Privatization.
What happens when corporations treat those public services as commodities to be bought and sold on the open market? And how are people in Canada and around the world protecting the public sphere and resisting corporate greed?
It's coming by leaps and bounds.
Thousands of people die because this economic model was imposed to war.
It is not sustainable, and we have an opportunity to stop it now.
You're listening to Conning the People, a five-part documentary series about privatization in Canada in an international context.
I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
We'll be investigating the effects of privatization globally and locally on healthcare, education, electricity, and water.
For the next half hour, we'll discuss globalization and privatization. We'll look at the impact of privatization on the Third World, the role of the U.S. government, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, free trade agreements, and the General Agreement on Trade and Services. Stay tuned. In the last 20 years, the scale of privatization has increased to such an extent that it's now the core of globalization. During the 1990s, $900 billion worth of state assets were sold to the private sector in more than 100 countries. Privatization's most disastrous impact has been in developing countries, where many valuable national assets have been sold to foreign corporations. These include health and education systems, utilities, airlines, telecommunications companies, and major industries and resource sectors that were the biggest revenue earners for countries in the South. This has meant increased poverty, unemployment, deindustrialization, and the end of national control over economies.
According to authors Jerry Mandler, Debbie Barker, and David Corton, the ideologies of economic globalization, including privatization, deregulation, free trade, and structural adjustment, have destroyed the livelihoods of millions of people, often leaving them homeless, landless, and hungry, while removing their access to even the most basic public services, such as health and medical care, education, sanitation, fresh water, and public transport. Privatization in Argentina has contributed towards the collapse of the economy. In the Philippines, privatization has meant deindustrialization and massive unemployment. And in South Africa, privatization has led to millions of people losing access to water and electricity.
Argentina was once the most prosperous and industrially developed country in Latin America. Today, it's a catastrophe. Its economy completely collapsed in December 2001. National income declined by 67%, and 50% of Argentines dropped below the poverty line. Argentina was the most faithful follower of neoliberal policies and, at the direction of the World Bank and IMF, privatized almost all state assets.
Jorge García Ogales is a labor researcher who works in solidarity with the Central Trabajadores de Argentinos, Argentina's radical Union Central, which is opposed to globalization and free market policies. He explained how Argentina's economic collapse was linked to privatization.
Privatization and Robin Hood in reverse. Instead of robbing to the poor, the rich to give to the poor, it's robbing to the poor to give to the rich. The water system, the oil system, forestry, trains, subways, airlines. Most of the banks are privatized. One of the first things that happened when this company start being managed by international corporation is that new work system will put in place, and immediately large number of people get laid off. Between 20-40% of the workforce in the different companies were laid off. And that is one way in which privatization hurt the economy and helped to the collapse. Second, the deindustrialization that we were talking about, because they start buying most of the technology, most of the equipment from their headquarters or sister companies instead of buying in the country. Third way, money. They did not reinvest their profit in the country. That amount of money that should be reinvested in the country, that should help to develop the internal economy, that should help to create jobs, instead of that, goes to headquarters in Spain, in France, in United States, any place in which headquarters is. we are talking about the investment because the money leaves. But the company headquarters send money back into the country. There is not proof that that money was in any way invested in any productive manner. Most of that money was invested in the financial market that was very high in interest. That's the fourth wave. The fifth wave, people start not having services. When you go just 45 minutes outside of the big cities, most people have no phone. Most people have no electricity. Water cannot be afforded. Then, and that is another and probably one of the most dramatic ways in which privatization contributed to the collapse.
The most disastrous privatization was that of Argentine banks. These were bought by foreign banks, which then looted Argentina and transferred the astronomical sum of $197 billion abroad, which crippled industrial production and destroyed the national banking system. Privatization meant the sucking out of Argentina's wealth into the coffers of the U.S. and other northern economies, leaving the country in total disintegration. As Jorge explains, one of the foreign banks that plundered Argentina by transferring billions of dollars abroad was the Bank of Nova Scotia. BNS owned a bank called Quilmes, Nova Scotia, in Argentina, the 12th largest bank in the country. When the economy collapsed, BNS sold this bank and left the country without returning the money of depositors. The Argentines who put money in Quilmes, Nova Scotia, did not get it back.
The Bank of Nova Scotia need to reinvest $700 million in Argentina to pay all the money that they have to pay to their savers, the people, the creditors. They decided not to invest that money. You say $700 million is a lot of money, and the
yes.
Bank of Nova Scotia will tell you, we cannot invest that money in Argentina because there is no possibility that we recover that money, and our shareholders in Canada deserve better. Now, the part that they are not telling you is that in a period of 10 years that they operated in Argentina, every 3 months, they made between $300 and $500 million. And they took it out of the country. By giving back the money that they make in 6 months, they could keep that bank opening and functioning. But their decision was, no, there is not a short-term perspective of making money here. Then we prefer just to walk away, take our money out, close the doors, and screw the people that gave us their money.
Not surprisingly, the Bank of Nova Scotia seems terrified of publicity about its actions.
The only thing that they are afraid is bad media in their countries. When we did a small demonstration in front of the Bank of Nova Scotia, in less than half an hour, the Vice President of International Affairs for Latin America was talking with us in their office, asking us to leave the street. And they were calling every paper to say that the information that we were given was not right and this and that. It was so interesting. They are just trying to cover up what they did in Argentina.
Extensive privatization in South Africa has led to 10 million people, a quarter of the population, losing access to water and electricity. It has also caused the worst cholera epidemic in the country's history. Jeff Rudin is a researcher for the South African Municipal Workers Union, which has 125,000 members.
In 1994, when democracy came to South Africa for the first time, the majority of South Africans had no access to water or sanitation or electricity. Since 1994, there has been impressive development in those areas. Large numbers, measured in millions, now have access to piped water, sanitation, and electricity. Unfortunately, they can't afford it because it's now the full cost recovery. As a result of which, at least one quarter of South Africans have had both water and the electricity cut off. That's 10 million having both cut off. Worse than that, at least 2 million South Africans have been evicted from their homes because they've been in arrears with water and electricity. And some of the arrears is as low as the equivalent of 37 Canadian dollars.
In 2002, South Africa suffered the worst cholera epidemic in its history, just 1 year after the water system of KwaZulu-Natal was privatized. For the first time, poor communities were charged fees for the water they used, and when they could not pay, the new corporate owners cut off supply. More than 260 people died. Cholera is spread by contact with contaminated water. There has been massive public opposition to privatization in South Africa. At the end of 2001, millions of people participated in a one-day strike against privatization organized by COSATU, the biggest labor federation, with 1.5 million members. COSATU is in a formal alliance with the ruling African National Congress.
The strike took place in order to try and demonstrate to the government that it was losing contact with the people it claimed to represent. And in that sense, it was very successful.
There has been major privatization in the Philippines for more than 10 years. Government-owned corporations, hotels and banks, an airline, steel company, mining, transportation, road construction, power companies, as well as the health and education sectors, have been privatized. Connie Soria works with BIAN, the New Patriotic Organization, a coalition of progressive groups in the Philippines.
Even before the West or Canada, for example, has started to talk about globalization, privatization, deregulation, and liberalization, all of this are already were already happening in the Philippines a decade ago. And the impact of, you know, privatization, particularly among the people in the communities, are very, very disastrous.
I remember, you know, a colleague who went to the Philippines. Her reaction, you know, when she came back, she said, it is the microcosm, you know, of globalization, where you see here, you know, the tall buildings that houses international corporations, big malls, and so on. And then just a few miles away or kilometers away from that, you have this big ghetto, you know, slums, poor people who have nothing at all.
65% of the population lives in poverty, and the economy is dependent on the $6 billion that 9 million Filipinos working abroad send home every year. Privatization has meant the dismantling of the Philippines' national industry, large-scale unemployment, and enormous migration.
When a certain government-owned company is privatized, the main interest there is to get profit, right? So there's this massive increase in prices, and there's no way that local companies can compete with international or multinational corporations because they have the capital, they have the influence and the machineries. And the impact of that is very tremendous to the people. First, the ever-rising prices. And secondly, it closes down, you know, local businesses. So you see people being terminated or laid off from work. So you have this mass number of unemployed. And there's no recourse for them but to start looking for work outside of the country. So basically that opens up again, you know, this door for massive migration of our workers, which becomes, you know, cheap labor again for these multinational corporations in different countries in the world. There is around 2,500 to 3,000 men and women leaving the country every day to look for work outside of the country, and 60 to 65% of this are women.
The disasters caused by privatization in Argentina, South Africa, and the Philippines have been repeated all over the developing world. Seven unionists have been killed in Colombia for protesting against the privatization of the telecommunications sector. The poor in India have lost access to health care when clinics have been privatized. In Ghana, water privatization will increase rates in a country where up to 70% of the urban population is poor and does not have piped water at home.
With power, here they come, international loan sharks, backed by the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and drag as champions of freedom.
The main international promoters of privatization are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which have made it a condition for loans to developing countries that are in debt to both institutions and to Western banks. Countries getting loans have to implement structural adjustment programs, which include cutting public expenditure, privatization of state enterprises, financial and trade liberalization, an increase in raw material exports and foreign investment, and an end to public subsidies for healthcare, education, and basic food needs. The World Bank and the IMF are agents for the United States government, which controls their decision-making. They carry out Washington's neocolonial agenda and that of multinational corporations, which seeks to integrate the developing world into the capitalist system in the subordinate position of raw material supplier and open market. Privatization ensures both these functions. B. Edwards is a researcher with Public Services International in Washington, who has studied the World Bank's role in Latin American countries.
The bank represents the interests of finance capital at an international level. And this capital is looking for profitable places for investment. And the bank paves the way for high returns on investment capital by opening new markets that previously were closed. And those new markets are public health, public education, social security, insurance, water, energy, telecommunications, all of these things which the public sector could and in many cases should operate.
The World Bank has used the debt of developing countries to enforce privatization of valuable national assets.
This is happening now in Peru. Peru has a very heavy debt burden, and the bank has encouraged the Toledo government to put virtually the entire infrastructure of the country up for sale.
By enforcing privatization, the World Bank has encouraged corruption in developing countries. Joseph Stiglitz, a former chief economist at the bank, called privatization briberization. He spoke of national leaders told to sell off their country's water and electricity companies who were keen to get commissions paid into Swiss bank accounts. You could see their eyes widen at the prospect, Stiglitz said. When the Nicaraguan government privatized its healthcare system under pressure from the World Bank, the process was marked by widespread corruption. The same occurred when pension funds in Central America were privatized at the bank's direction.
Another part of that operation, which the World Bank was also involved in, was the privatization of the social security systems in Central American countries, because the social security systems are also run through the ministries of health. And there, too, there has been just a wave of corruption in the contracting out of these services to small, unmonitored, and incapable or incompetent companies, justified by saying that these companies are more competitive and more efficient than the public sector.
Along with the U.S., the bank also serves the interests of multinational corporations anxious to get their hands on the resources of developing countries through privatization. Ed Finn is general editor of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives in Ottawa.
The corporations, of course, have always looked at public services as what one CEO described as a large unopened oyster. The corporations were largely excluded from the public sector up until the 1970s. But since then, with the help of their political buddies, they've taken over a huge share of public services and agencies. Business leaders essentially want the public sector to be made as small as possible to create what they call market freedom. They want to ensure that all the important decisions about what and how to produce and with what resources are made by business, not by government. They hold up the supply and demand market as the ideal model for our whole society. In this warped view, public services are merely products to be bought and sold, and as such, they can allegedly be more effectively provided by the private sector.
In addition to the World Bank and the IMF, the U.S. government and corporations also push privatization through the World Trade Organization, WTO, and international agreements such as the General Agreement on Trade and Services, GATS, and the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. The World Trade Organization has about 150 member countries, including Canada. the WTO's goal is continuous liberalization of trade. The WTO agreements actually regulate governments in a constitutional sense. They determine what governments are permitted and not permitted to do. The WTO administers an agreement called the General Agreement on Trade in Services, GATS, which is aimed at liberalizing services. The goal is more trade in services by private companies, which means more privatization of companies as well. In this sense, the WTO works in concert with the World Bank and the IMF, which require southern governments to carry out privatization as a condition for loans.
Scott Sinclair is the senior policy researcher with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives and a leading expert on the General Agreement on Trade and Services.
The GATS does operate on what's called a positive list approach. So there's a list of services categorized, you know, from medical services to energy transmission and so on and so forth, you know, 140 or more different types of services. And some rules apply to all services, but the heavy-duty rules in the GATS only apply to services that the countries agree to list. Now, Canada's already agreed in 1995 to list about 100 different service sectors. But in sectors that are fully covered under the GATS, there are restrictions on government monopolies. So actually, in a service that's fully listed, government monopolies are not permitted. So an example of a government monopoly is in Canada, we have public health insurance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for medically necessary services, private insurers are not allowed. And that would be considered a barrier to trade under an agreement like the GATS.
Once you allow the private sector and what has been the public provision of a service or a good, NAFTA gives these private companies extraordinary new rights to enforce privatization. An alarming example of this is the lawsuit that United Parcel Services, a U.S. corporation, brought against the Canadian government in January 2000. Deborah Burke is president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers.
They're basically using the investor state rules of the North American Free Trade Agreement to sue the Canadian government for $230 million. Basically, UPS is complaining about the fact that we have a publicly funded public postal service in this country that actually dares to compete in the parcel and express courier market. And what UPS is trying to do is get a much bigger portion of that parcel and express courier market, and they're using NAFTA to try and do that. We're concerned. We've seen the Canadian government settle some of these cases in the past, and we think there's been rather disastrous results. And we worry that a settlement would give UPS greater access to Canada Post Network, the public-funded network of postal facilities, mailboxes, delivery trucks, that kind of thing. So that would allow UPS to increase its share of the urban market by piggybacking on Canada Post's network. And that would leave a lot less money for Canada Post to finance our public post office, to finance its universal service obligations in rural communities.
The impact of the UPS lawsuit goes far beyond postal services.
We also see that the UPS NAFTA case has real threats not just to the public postal system, but to other important public services like healthcare or education. Any place where you have a public service where there's also some services provided by the private sector, wherever you have that mix, which is more and more common these days, you're going to see public services opened up to these challenges by foreign investors like UPS.
Sinister and cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck.
In enforcing privatization in developing countries, the World Bank, IMF, WTO, NAFTA, and GATS are continuing a process started by the CIA and the Pentagon. Since the 1950s, the U.S. government has used military coups, wars, invasions, death squads, assassinations, and covert action to eradicate progressive governments and movements in the Third World that wish to control their economies and use their resources for the benefit of their own people. Liberation movements and left-wing governments in Chile, Indonesia, Angola, Mozambique, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Argentina, Colombia, and many other southern countries opposed foreign domination of their economies and policies like privatization which advanced this. They wished to redistribute wealth and expand the public sector in order to further national development. The U.S.'s answer to this was genocide, the killing of about 8 million people in the Third World. It is this slaughter that paved the way for global privatization. Edgar Godoy is a unionist from Guatemala. He is chair of the International Solidarity Committee of the Canadian Union of Public Employees.
The whole process of globalization for us meant, in a single word, death. Thousands of people die because this economic model was imposed to war. Guatemala was in a civil war conflict for 36 years that cost 250,000 lives. El Salvador was in a war that lasted 20 years. Nicaragua went through the same process. Now we have the rebellion in southern Mexico, the Zapatista that started the rebellion the day that the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed, January 94. But the grossest example that I can give you now, it's Colombia, where they're trying to impose this economic model, very oppressive moral in a way that they are financing the war. They are providing arms, they are providing training to the Colombian army, and in a way they are helping in the massacres and the killing of thousands of people of Colombia. And the people of Colombia are still resisting, saying, no, we prefer to die with dignity before you do it. You know, we will not allow you to privatize our public services. The little that is left, people are still fighting.
U.S. policy towards the Third World can be summed up as kill the people so you can steal their wealth. Genocide made possible large-scale privatization, liberalization, deregulation, and free trade, which have resulted in a massive transfer of wealth from south to north during the last two decades. As a former World Bank director remarked, not since the conquistadors plundered Latin America has the world experienced such a flow in the direction we see today. But the U.S. and multinational corporations aren't satisfied with pillaging only developing economies. The next stage, already underway, is the dismantling of the public sector in northern countries, including Canada, where healthcare, education, electricity, and water services face privatization. The northern elite's successful plunder of the South has emboldened it to loot its own middle class. However, here the means are not death squads and wars, they are lies and propaganda. Rather than killing the people, the strategy is conning them into believing that privatization will benefit them. In our next four shows, we look at privatization in Canada in the electricity, water, health, and education sectors.
You've been listening to Conning the People, Privatization in Canada.
This series was written and researched by Asad Ismi.
Produced by Kristen Schwartz.
And executive producer Asad Ismi.
Narrated by Kristen Schwartz and Asad Ismi.
Funded by the Canadian Labour Congress, Canadian Union of Public Employees, Canadian Union of Postal Workers, Communications, Energy and Paper Workers, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, and the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association.
Thanks also to CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, Christiana Clemens for technical assistance,
and Wing Hong Si for sounds. Music credits for this segment, Money by Pink Floyd and Call It Democracy by Bruce Coburn.
For copies of this program, call 416-595-5068 or email news@ckln.fm.
Thank you for listening.